and very active, and we're extremely active and trying to help lead agency. And so it's really an honor and privilege to be here this morning. Let me tell you what I'm going to try to do, and hopefully it will be constructive. I'm going to start off by talking a little bit generically about the budget, what it means, where we are, and dig into a couple of the president's new initiatives, and also give a little context for a master budget. And then go through some of the regulatory issues and a little discussion on supply and demand associated with commercial space transportation. I think the general takeaway here should be that two things are active. One is the administration has been actively engaged and cared very much about having a viable commercial space transportation sector. It's something that's important. It's important both from the U.S. government standpoint as an acquirer of services. It's important long term in terms of the private sector and having a viable and dynamic industry out there that is not exclusively relying on the federal government as its primary source of revenue. So let me start by going to a picture of the federal budget. We just rolled out the federal budget. It's not small. It's $2.77 trillion. That's a lot of money. I think one of the important things, and I think most of you are aware of that, the discretionary portion of that is only $877 billion. That again is a large number, but if you look at it as a fraction of the overall budget, you start realizing that the amount of discretionary money in the budget is only a fraction of the budget. And then you go down and look at that fraction from a variety of different metrics, one being non-defense related, you realize that the overall money available is for the federal government in terms of its ability to redirect resources and in terms of its ability to actually set priorities is reasonably limited. And that's important to know because that means every year there is always going to be significant competition for resources in the future budget. And that actually doesn't get better over time, it gets worse over time, because entitlements grow faster than the discretionary budget. As I say, it's a very important thing to understand that every year there is going to be increased competition for ever scarcer federal discretionary dollars. Within that climate, I think there is something that is not often discussed, and that is the fact that the federal government, this administration, has really prioritized research and development. If you look at the two big charts on the screen, that is a graph of the conduct of research and development in every time, actually, $50,000. And you can see that over the last 5 years, there's been a dramatic increase in overall R&D spending by the federal government. That's both within the total budget, from the perspective of including defense, and also if you back up defense, which is the lower graph. In total, the president is asking for $137 billion for R&D in FY07. That would be a 50% increase from 2001. That's a really very significant commitment for R&D, and I think it goes to the fact that both on the defense and non-defense side, R&D is a critical component of the federal budget, from the president's perspective, in terms of ensuring that our country is competitive in the long term. I'll speak a little bit more about a specific initiative that the president stood up on this issue. To give you a picture of where the R&D money goes, obviously defense is the single largest portion at about $74.2 billion. Then it's health-related research. HHS is at $28.7 billion. That has grown substantially with the doubling of the NIH budget over the last 5 years, actually. About 2 years ago now. And then NASA's third. NASA had about $2 billion, and this is R&D, not its entire budget. And then energy at 9.2, and assessment 4.5, and then other agencies such as agriculture, something about $2 billion. Within that context, the president this year in the State of the Union launched a new initiative that he really feels is critical to maintain the U.S. competitiveness over the long term. And that's the American competitiveness initiative. What you see on the screen is a graph of what's going to happen to the three selected agency budgets that have been singled out for increases in research funding to ensure long-term competitiveness in the U.S. Those agencies are the Department of Energy, Office of Science, the National Science Foundation, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Those three agencies are slated under their initiative to double over the next 10 years. And that averages out to about 7% increase annually. That money is somewhat front-loaded. They actually are getting a 9.3% increase up front this year in 2007, which totals to about $910 million, or $2 billion this year alone. The total cost of that large green wedge is $50 billion. So it's an additional $50 billion of commitment to R&D for those three agencies over the next 10 years. The total cost of the proposal is a little over $136 billion over 10 years. And one of the big portions of that is making the research and experimentation tax credit permanent, which we believe is extremely important because we want to make sure that the private sector knows and can rely on the tax system in order to incent further investment in research and development. As all of you are aware, two-thirds of the R&D funding that are spending is less than the private sector. So the government is only a third of the overall effort. And the president believes very strongly that we really need to continue to lead the world in R&D over the long term. And therefore, we want to make sure that both on the federal side and on the private side, R&D spending continues to be strong. A third critical element of the American Cannabis Initiative here is education, math and science education. And the president believes very strongly that we want to make sure that students in the U.S. Have the best skills in the world. And so committed an additional $380 million in the next year and additional funds thereafter to strengthen our ability to teach courses such as AP and international law courses at the high school level, to do research on what works in terms of math and science education, make sure that they're implemented through the schools, and also to focus on worker retraining so that U.S. workers have the skills necessary to keep. Again, you know, if you look at the way the American Competitiveness Initiative is set up, it's really, really based on the notion of reliance on R&D and innovation to make sure that long-term the country remains competitive. And I think that ties in extremely well with what you all do in the commercial space transportation arena, and also obviously what NASA does. The snapshot of NASA's budget for next year, you're probably fairly familiar with it. But NASA's request for NASA and the President's budget is $16.8 billion. That's a 3.2% increase. And that's when you actually back out the one-time money for treatment that was paid out last year. It's important to put that in context. That's a 3.2% increase when the overall discretionary budget from non-defense is going down by 0.5%. So NASA is being prioritized over other discretionary portions of the budget. And again, you know, it's very often you forget what that really means. But what that really means is that the administration, the president, has decided that NASA is more important than a lot of other programs that are extremely popular. And that's one of the reasons why it's really important for all of you and all of us continue to discuss and talk about how important NASA is within the federal budget, because as we go forward and the fact that discretionary money is not going to be more available in the future, or less available in the future, it's it's really critical that these kind of investments continue to justify long term. Otherwise, you're not going to see this discrepancy. You're not going to see a prioritization long term in this field unless we continue to justify why that's necessary. And clearly, the president of the administration feels very strongly that NASA is an extremely important priority. The president laid out his vision for where he wants NASA to go. Mike has done a phenomenal job implementing that. Tremendous confidence in the White House and his leadership. And it clearly is a priority for this administration, and it's certainly hopefully a priority going forward for the next administration and administrations after that. Really quickly, as shown in the slides, within the NASA budget, you'll see that there's $6.2 billion for shuttle and space station, $4 billion for exploration, which I think includes CDD, and then $5.3 billion for Earth and space science. And let me make a really quick comments about space, Earth, space science. One is that figure represents 1.5% increase in funding. The administration and NASA obviously feel very strongly that space science is extremely important. There have been some wonderful accomplishments this year, including the Jupiter Camp and Stardust, including the Horizon, and actually And I think that there's no question that NASA's Earth and space science is an important component, not just of NASA, but also of the President's vision going forward. Turning directly to space policy activities, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to summarize sort of overarching space policy activities. The main point I would stress today is that the last 3 years have been an extremely active period for the White House in terms of developing and releasing space policies. In that time, the commercial remote sensing policy has been released, space exploration, vision, space positioning, navigation, and timing, and space transportation policies have all been released. And as you know, we continue to work to develop a national space policy to replace a policy that dates back to 1996. Implementing such policies is often as challenging as drafting, if not more difficult. And much remains to be done in this area. Each of these policies lays out specific tasks and activities for agencies, and the White House offices are monitoring the process very closely. OECD is deeply involved in the development and implementation of these policies. In that process, we work very closely with a range of other key agencies and offices in the executive office. It's truly a team effort, and we believe it works very well. These policies are of particular interest because they contain several specific provisions on subjects of commercial space transportation. For example, the space transportation policy notes the important goals of encouraging and facilitating commercial space transportation in support of U.S. national security, civil space, and economic interests. In addition, it requires USG agencies to purchase commercially available U.S. space transportation services as much as possible within the constraints of mission requirements and applicable law. It also addresses several other commercial issues, such as the need for timely and responsive regulatory environment. Similarly, the vision underscores the need to pursue commercial opportunities for missions such as space transportation or the International Space Station. So where does that leave us in terms of facilitating world growth of the commercial space transportation sector generally, and especially the new area of commercial human space travel? First, it is clear from the preceding chart that the administration strongly supports the basic goals of a strong, dynamic U.S. commercial space transportation sector. There are well-known benefits of such activities in terms of innovation, national security, and the nation's economy. And this type of top-level administrative support is certainly not a bad place to start. But it is also not enough. There are at least three major factors that will fundamentally impact the growth and robustness of this sector, and they will not surprise any informed audience such as this. Those factors are government policies and regulations, and the familiar elements of market supply and demand. Here I would like to distinguish between the traditional market of commercial launches of geocommunication satellites or remote sensing satellites and the emerging commercial human spaceflight sector. The former is reasonably well established and understood. It is facing significant oversupply globally and serious competitive pressures. But at the same time, there are several established proven players in the market, and demand has been reasonably predictable. Our letter focused on emerging commercial human spaceflight sector. This sector is intriguing because not only are government policies and regulations beginning to come into focus, and the sector certainly is in its infancy with regard to supply and demand. This means that it both has a great potential and great uncertainty. On the supply side, there recently has been a major upswing in the number of entrepreneurial companies that are developing capacities for supplying cargo and ultimately carrying the crew to the International Space Station, suborbital flights with humans on board, more traditional commercial launches and services. One of these spacecrafts, Spaceship One, recently became the first privately built vehicle to reach the lower edges of space, a major accomplishment. The presence of so many possible players makes it clear that everything is top, but it's hard to say how many can survive or succeed. This brings us to the issue of demand. There appear to be two major sources of demand in the present time. The U.S. government need for cargo and crew services for ISS, as well as a more general need for responsive small vehicles. Suborbital tourism market, as evidenced by Richard Branson's Virgin Galactica, for suborbital tourist flights is also another demand. These are works in progress, and the market characteristics are only partly understood. We can safely say that demand exists, but whether it's sufficient, we cannot say. This uncertainty makes innovative concepts such as projects all the more important at this early stage of the sector's development. Here I am referring to things such as the $10 million X Prize won by Spaceship One and NASA's Centennial Challenge. We support the concept of such efforts and believe that it could be very important in ultimately making the sector succeed. I noted earlier that government sources of demand would be important, and that the ISS servicing missions is particularly significant in this regard. NASA already has initiated a procurement process for such services, with an emphasis on ISS cargo, servicing, and eventually even crew transportation if operators can demonstrate an acceptable capability in this regard. I want to emphasize that this activity relates directly to the commercial goals outlined in the agreement. Even more to the point, NASA's efforts to provide opportunities to the commercial sector for cargo and crew delivery to the ISS are important to the vision over the long run. As you are no doubt aware, NASA's COTS RFP are due out March 2006, and NASA's budget supports COTS demonstrations at a level of $91 million per year, $500 million over the next 5 year period. That's a substantial investment. In addition to supply and demand, another major piece of the puzzle is regulatory environment. Here, as well, significant progress has been made in recent months. Congress added some momentum to the process through the Commercial Space Launch Amendment Act of 2003. This statute authorizes FAA to regulate the commercial human spaceflight sector, primarily to protect the public and public interest. For the next 8 years, the FAA can regulate space vehicles to ensure crew and passenger safety only if the operation of those vehicles results in death, serious injury, or dangerously close calls. After 2012, the FAA may regulate space vehicles as it sees fit. The FAA is also working on a number of rules. A human spaceflight requirements for crew and spaceflight participants, NPRM, balances the requirements to ensure public safety without over-restricting activities in the space field. Two additional NPRMs are also in progress. The experimental permits for reusable suborbital rockets and licensing and safety requirements for launch. These future NPRMs will attempt to be flexible and not place unreasonable burdens on growth in the sector. This is the approach urged by Congress, and we believe it is the right one. Yeah. There are great opportunities and challenges ahead for commercial space transportation, including commercial convenience space travel. Clearly, the government has an important role. However, if we are ever to have the kind of dynamic commercial space flight industry we all want, it will only occur through private sector risk taking. As the President has stated, the role of government is not to create wealth. The role of government is to create the environment in which entrepreneurs can flourish, in which minds can expand, in which technologies can reach new frontiers. The administration is committed to establishing that environment. It will ultimately be the private sector that will take us to the new commercial frontier. With that, I thank you again for having me this morning, and I hope you take a few questions.
For them and NASA be one of those agencies that really benefited from the competitiveness initiative, and if so, is there a way that we could do something that would be part of that in the future?
The answer is yes, in terms of looking at all agencies. One of the things we did when the President put together the American Competitiveness Initiative, we went through all the various agencies, specifically looking at long-term trends in physical sciences and physical science research, and looked at and compared sort of where different agencies were on that track, where fundamental enabling research was occurring that was directly linked to competitiveness, and where agencies might have been lagging behind other agencies in terms of the need for additional resources, to make sure that the entire apparatus of federal R&D budget works. One excellent example of that is being the Office of Science, which largely has had a flat budget, yet it supports a lot of the infrastructure necessary for the rest of the federal government and the private sectors of that matter to actually accomplish a lot of what we expect from them in terms of innovation. You'll notice that we picked either complete agencies or complete pieces of agency. Obviously, you couldn't do all of the Department of Energy and pick the Office of Science. When you start looking at it that way, it was impossible to fit NASA into the proposal. And although NASA clearly does extremely high quality basic research in the physical sciences, if you look at a lot of where the research is and what it's supporting, it's in many pieces supporting expanding our overall knowledge of the universe. It's not necessarily directly supporting a lot of the other agencies as well that are working on things that will be long term and make a big difference in terms of the commercial viability of the country. That's not to say that NASA doesn't do some of that work as well, but to include all of NASA is probably the fact that we're working with the context of this.
Are no guarantees you're looking into as a possible incentive for commercial launch companies?
I think we're open to all concepts. I think there has to be a lot of justification.
It was outstanding to see the RS-88 engine being shared for 3 years with Rocket Plane. Is that technology sharing going to continue with other private space?
That's a level of specificity well outside of my knowledge.
In conjunction with the new initiative, particularly the increase in funding, to what extent is there any look at the existing infrastructure to evaluate whether it's still conducive to the objectives you want to achieve?
When you say existing, are you going to
the organizational strength of bureaucracy.
But for the entire R&D complex of the U.S. government.
Correct.
Absolutely. I think that there actually are two components of the initiative which I did discuss. One is that we believe very strongly that in order to succeed, in order for the money associated with the American Defenders, initiatives to have the maximum value, you can't be minimal. If that's your question in a second. And that's because we really believe that this money has to be spent in ways that are either peer review, competitive war associated with a long-term plan that's been set out by the individual agencies to do, and this gets to your point, to actually figure out what needs to be done, what facilities we need to support, which facilities are critical, and which people too. And people are part of the overall framework that's used to ensure both the conduct of our R&D continues and also our long-term competitiveness. Which are the critical pieces associated with each of those agencies? So I very much expect that we're going to continue to do reviews as to where the first dollars within these individual areas across the entire R&D spectrum should go. And facilities are a major issue. There's no question about that. As a matter of fact, when OCP through its coordinating mechanism, which is the National Science and Technology Council, has been working specifically on scientific facilities for a couple of years now, and it's a major concentration. There are coalition facilities. One is obviously a lot of our agents. If you look at the land, a lot of money back to building. The other is that when you have issues like earmarking, oftentimes facilities that get built, and then it's very unclear how it fits with the broad picture where the funding streams be coming from to actually give them work to do, and oftentimes that takes away from the work done at other facilities.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
I'm loath to defend earmarking, but there's an element of earmarking that reflects, frankly, the dysfunction in federal government. And not just, I don't mean anything particularly about any agencies represented here, but to just use diabetes as an example, there's been a phenomenal amount of earmarking, frankly, based on complete lack of confidence in the Defense Department's system to develop counters for the explosives in Iraq. And the point I want to make, I guess, is that there is a growing consensus that the growth of bureaucracy in Washington is choking just about anything that remains of the mission. And so the real thrust of my question is, are we going to achieve the objectives that the administration is setting out in terms of sponsoring, spurring initiatives and more R&D activity and particularly private sector activity, if we don't address some of the organizational issues? And I guess that's what I'm curious in the space area, whether that's been part of the analysis.
Well, two different pieces of that. There's no question that any stream of funding, and if it's well directed, has significant benefit. The problem, and the reason that earmark was specifically called out within the American competitiveness initiative, is that if you have funding that's going to things that are outside the roadmap associated with these agencies or the individual goals of the program, it's oftentimes very hard to actually accomplish whatever the goals are. I'm going to give you two quick examples on that. One is the hydrogen fuel initiative. We've been getting reports from a lot of outside, in fact, actually industry, because of the high level of earmarking within hydrogen fuel initiative, they think we're going to miss most of our milestones. That's a real problem. The reports we're getting from folks on the outside are saying that they do about 25% of the money is not supporting the overall goals. That's significant. Another example, of this goes to facilities. Under the American Competitiveness, the budget for NIST goes up 24%. Except if you actually look at the budget for NIST, you open up the budget, you see it's actually negative. Well, the reason is that 24% is swamped by earmarks last year for facilities that really has nothing to do with NIST core missions. And so it can have a huge impact on whether these agencies can do their work. In terms of reviewing how agencies work, there are two levels to that. One is the individual agencies and the facilities agencies, which are constantly trying to do that and make sure their agencies function as best as possible. The second level of that is all these parks boards, where they actually try to drill down and figure out who's doing a good job and who's doing a good job. One more question. I knew this was a mistake.
I want to thank you, as a representative of the executive office for the president here, for giving the entrepreneurs who want to provide services to NASA a chance, for not just supporting Mike Griffin in his request for $500 million over the next 4 years for the cost program, but actually for increasing the budget. for ISS crew and cargo services, so the resources will be there. We're aggressively going to demonstrate these capabilities. I want to suggest that there are other areas beneath Earth orbit in the suborbital space where NASA can benefit from a lot of the suborbital vehicles that are being developed for crew training, microgravity experiments, remote sensing, sensor testing, things like that. So there's some interesting opportunities to the prizes and combine services there. And in fact, the Air Force is getting very interested in that. Their operational responsive space folks are looking at partnering with some of these entrepreneurial companies as well. And there may be, you know, capitalism could work above Earth orbit too. So I'm sure after we've proven ourselves in Earth orbit, Mr. Grissom will give us a chance to go further too. So I wanted to thank you and thank you. Like, it's really great and we're excited. Thanks.
I said, I need to reassess who I'm calling first. I should have called on you. Thanks, everyone. Really appreciate it.